start off with, in terms of stress, what I wanted to emphasize is the significance of the word stress itself, because its definition has changed over the years. And we now have an important distinction that we need to be aware of, so that when we're talking about stress, we really do mean stress, that we are not confusing it with pressure. So, the first point I want to emphasize is this distinction between pressure and stress. And the key difference is this. Pressure is neutral in the sense that it can be positive or negative. Pressure can be positive in the sense that it can motivate you, it can energize you, you can find it rewarding and enriching, stimulating. So there are positives to pressure. Pressure can give you a buzz, you know, pressure can give you a good feeling. But pressure can also be negative in the sense that pressure can harm us. For example, when there's too much pressure, or the pressure goes on for too long without a break, or there are too many different pressures all at the same time, it can work in different ways. So do you see what I'm trying to say is that pressure is neutral in the sense of it depends on the circumstances. It can be positive or it can be negative. There's nothing intrinsically positive or negative about pressure. It depends on the circumstances. Stress, by contrast, is now recognized as where pressures are negative to the point where they are harming you in some way. Where they are perhaps making you ill, they're undermining your self-esteem, they are affecting your relationships. Pressures may be affecting how well you do your job. You know, quantity or quality of work could be affected by too much pressure or too many pressures. So, can you see this important distinction? Pressure is neutral. Could be good, could be bad. Stress is negative. Stress is where it's hurting you in some way. It's causing you harm. Now, it's important to make that distinction because pressure is to be expected. You get paid for pressure. Do you see what I'm getting at? You can't complain if you are getting paid that people are making demands on you. They want stuff from you. They're putting you under pressure. Well, of course they are. That's why they pay you. But do you see how when those pressures cross a line to the point where they are harming you in some way, then that's where we start talking about stress, and that's potentially illegal. Because of the health and safety legislation, organisations are under a duty, a legal and a moral duty, to safeguard their staff from undue hazards. That's the key term, undue hazards. And what undue hazards can mean is, you know, simple, straightforward things that you're probably used to, like signs on a floor that's just been mopped saying caution, wet floor. Electrical equipment being properly earthed. Stuff like that. So those are attempts to avoid undue hazards. But what's been established through case law precedent is that stress is an undue hazard. And what I mean by established by case law precedent is that if you go to the health and safety legislation, it doesn't actually talk about stress. Because at the time that legislation was introduced, they didn't think of stress in terms of health and safety. But there have been sufficient cases now that have actually gone through court and established a precedent. Yeah, that's the idea. Case law precedent has been enough cases to establish that stress is to be included under the heading of undue hazards. So another legal technical term is a duty of care. Employers have a duty of care towards their staff. Now what that means is that organisations have to take steps to avoid staff being stressed. So can you see now why it's important to distinguish between pressure and stress? Because they have no duty to avoid you being pressurized. They're paying you to be pressurized. Yeah? They're paying you to do a job, to have demands made on you. But they have to make appropriate efforts to make sure that they don't cross that line to the point where the pressures are actually harming you in some way. So that makes a huge difference in terms of how we understand stress. And it means that very often when people use the term stress in everyday language, when they use it loosely, it's actually different from how it's used in a technical sense. So you'll have people, for example, say things like, "Oh, I had a difficult day today, it was really stressful." Now, do you think they really mean it was harming their health, it was harming their relationships, it was undermining their self-esteem or whatever? What they really mean was, "I had a pressurized day today." So it's no good going to, you know, a tribunal, for example, an employment tribunal, and saying, "I want to sue my employers because I was under pressure today." Can you say, "Well, that's what you paid for," is the short answer to that. But if it really is stress, if it's getting to the point where it's actually harming you, then that is a serious issue. So I often run courses on stress management, and this is one of the things that I emphasize. If you're talking about stress, make sure you are talking about stress, because it just confuses the issue. You know, to say, for example, some people will say, "Social work is a stressful job." Now, can you say how that's not strictly true? Because that saying, social work will damage your health. Whereas the reality is, social work can damage your health if you're not careful. But it's not inevitable. Stress is not inevitable. That you will be harmed by the pressures you experience. There are things we, as professionals, including managers, can do about that to prevent stress. So what would be more accurate is to say social work is a pressurized job, and if you don't manage it well, it can become stressful. And one of the things we'll talk about tomorrow is self-management, self-leadership, and that will be part of that. It's also relevant, of course, to what we're discussing now. So let me just say a bit more about this next bit, and then I'll throw it open for if you've got any comments or questions before we proceed beyond that. I want to give you this definition of stress from two writers called Aroba and James. And they define stress as your response to an inappropriate level of pressure. Now, there's two significant things about that definition. One is that they talk about an inappropriate level of pressure, not just too much pressure. So it can be stressful when you've got too little pressure. So some jobs are stressful because they're too routine, they're too mundane. There's no challenge, there's nothing to interest you, there's nothing to give you job satisfaction. So it just becomes tedious. And that can be stressful. But also, what can happen in social work, because you might be thinking, well, it's hardly likely to happen in social work, is it? You know, working in McDonald's, maybe, but not in social work. But in reality, do you see how if people become culture victims and they are just like welfare bureaucrats, they're just filling in forms and rationing scarce resources, do you see how there's nothing interesting or stimulating about that? So it can become stressful when you're not getting anything out of the job. It's just like an administrative job for somebody who didn't want an administrative job. So that it becomes boring, it becomes tedious, it becomes routine, people become semi-burnt out, and then that can be stressful, where it's actually, they've sort of manoeuvred themselves into a position where they are not getting any rewards, any stimulation from their job, and then that can be stressful. But the other important thing about this definition is note that it says not stress is an appropriate level of pressure, but stress is your response to an inappropriate level of pressure. In other words, there is a subjective dimension to stress. And that's got at least two sets of implications. One is that partly whether you experience stress or not is down to how you respond to the pressures. So, for example, some people can make the pressures worse and then create stress for themselves, for example, by panicking. And you see, if you're under pressure, that pressure won't necessarily make you stressed, but if you panic and you make the situation worse, that can then prove stressful. But another implication of this subjective element of stress is that different people will find different things stressful. Yep. So what you can take in your stride and doesn't bother you in the slightest, someone else may find very anxiety provoking, a significant pressure, and it could well be stressful, and vice versa. There may be something that you'd really struggle with and find a potential source of stress that someone else just takes in their stride. There's actually an example of this going on right at this very moment. Anybody know what the hell I'm talking about? I'm doing public speaking right now. Been doing it for 27 years. Doesn't bother me in the slightest. Don't feel the slightest bit nervous doing it. And yet, is it not fair to say that a significant number of people would be on the verge of a panic attack if they were asked to do public speaking? Do you see what I'm getting at? Now, I'm not saying, aren't I wonderful, look what I can do, because there may be things that other people do that I would struggle with, that I would find really difficult to do and potentially get stressed about. Do you see what I'm getting at? It's basically horses for courses, in a sense, you know, that different people find different things potentially stressful. So we're back to the self-awareness theme again. Do you see how an important part of this is you need to be aware of, in a sense, what are your trigger points? What are the things that get you feeling very anxious, feeling really pressurized, which perhaps other people would take in their stride, where it wouldn't bother them in the slightest, where they just get on with it? Yeah. I mean, an example of that might be that some people, for example, if they encounter someone else's anger, they get really worked up about it. Whereas other people can just calmly deal with that anger and calm somebody down. So do you see how it's not just the pressure of dealing with anger, but it's how we respond to it that matters. If we internalize it, for example. So I suspect you come across this distinction between, on the one hand, sympathy, and on the other hand, empathy. Yeah? That sympathy is where you share the feeling with somebody. If they're upset, you're upset. If they're disappointed, you're disappointed. If they're grieving, you're grieving. And so on. Sympathy means sharing feelings. Empathy means understanding or recognizing feelings. And in social work, that's what we'll, in the caring professions generally, that's what we have to aim for, is empathy, not sympathy. Can you see how if you went in for sympathy, you'd be hard pushed to last a month? Can you imagine every time you met somebody who's angry, you get angry? Every time you met somebody who's depressed, you became depressed. So what we have to do, and this is the real skill of empathy, is to be able to recognize other people's feelings and respond to them constructively without necessarily feeling them ourselves, because that will disempower us. We'll be overloaded with emotion if we do that. And that's part of the problem of burnout that we've touched on a couple of times, is what happens in burnout is empathy goes, that people just develop this sort of like emotional thick skin, that they are protecting themselves from emotional issues, but that means they can't then recognize emotional issues in other people. So the healthy balance, if you like, between sympathy on the one hand and burnout on the other is empathy. So being able to respond to other people's feelings is potentially a source of stress, but it's also potentially a way of avoiding stress if we learn how to do that. Okay, so we've covered some significant issues already. Distinction between pressure and stress, important not to get the two confused, because although they overlap to a certain extent, there are very subtle but significant differences between them. And then also recognizing that the importance of this definition, stress is your response to an inappropriate level of pressure, particularly that subjective element. To be able to sue an employer, you would have to show that the level of pressure has harmed you in some way. So just saying, I don't like my job, it's boring, it's tedious, would not be grounds for suing an employer. If it is the level of pressure has harmed somebody in some way, then they would. I mean, I'll give you an example of this. I was involved as an expert witness once in a case of a social worker who had been overloaded and went off sick with stress. And then she came back after a while of sick leave and was very quickly overloaded again and went off sick a second time. Then when she came back a third time, the employers had learnt the lesson to a certain extent and they didn't overload her. But what they did was they underloaded her. What they did was she was a qualified, very competent, experienced social worker. But they just gave her very basic, tedious things to do, just like running errands and stuff like that. And that she then found stressful. So at that point, she issued a claim to sue her employers to say that they have given me too much work and now they're basically treating me like a child. They're treating me like just a sort of a clerical assistant when I'm a qualified, experienced social worker. So that was the basis of her. So it wouldn't simply be, you know, somebody's bored at work and they then decide to sue them. It would have to be more complex than that. But coming back to your first question about the issue of employers cannot be accountable, in a sense, for subjective dimension, that's quite right. Because the law doesn't make employers 100% responsible. The law says that employers must take reasonable steps. And if employers have taken reasonable steps and somebody still gets stressed because of their own way of dealing with the situation, then they can't blame the organisation for that. Because interestingly, one of the important things about the health and safety legislation is that it not only places a duty of care on employers, but also on employees. So, for example, if there is a wet floor because it's just been mopped, and there is a sign there saying, caution, wet floor, can you see how the employers have done their bit? You go running across it, break your leg, don't blame the employers, that was down to you failing in your duty of care. Do you see what I'm getting at? The same applies to stress. If you are doing things that your employers would not approve of, but you're stressing yourself out, can you see how you don't have grounds then for suing your employers? And I'll tell you a sad but true story about this. Is another expert witness case that I had where it was related to a woman who was a college lecturer. She'd taken early retirement on health grounds because of stress. What happened was that she had a new boss at one point, and the new boss was, to put it bluntly, a waste of space. He didn't do his job properly. And the students were losing out because of this. And this particular lecturer, she was very committed to the students having a positive learning experience. So what she did was work lots of extra hours, not only doing her own job, but doing those parts of her boss's job that he should have been doing but wasn't. And doing this over a long period of time made her very ill, and she had a breakdown. And as a result of that breakdown, she wasn't able to go back to work. She couldn't face going back to those pressures. And so she was given early retirement on the grounds of health issues. And it was only after she'd retired And she realized that she missed her old job. She missed working with students and helping to give them a good, positive learning experience. That she started to feel angry that her employers had basically ruined her career. Because they had, as she saw it, overloaded her, made her ill, and resulted in a breakdown, they had ruined her career. So she went to see a solicitor to see about suing her employers, and that's exactly what happened. And then I was asked to write a report as an expert witness for court. And I interviewed this lecturer as part of writing my report. And what I feared would happen actually happened. And I'll tell you exactly what happened. When the case came to court, the lecturer was cross-examined by the barrister for representing the college she worked at. And the barrister said to her, "Am I right in thinking that your claim is that your employers, the college, put you under too great a level of pressure and that resulted in your breakdown and in the need for you to retire, and that that has had an adverse effect on your career and you're now claiming compensation for that?" And she said, "Yes, that's exactly what I'm claiming." And then the barrister said, "Okay. At what point did you realise that the pressures of work were making you ill?" And she gave, you know, some sort of date. You know, she said, "Oh, it was around about March or whatever it was." That, and so the barrister said, "So, it was around that time you realised that the pressures at work were making you ill. What did you do about it?" And she said, "Well, I was taking work home with me in the evenings and I was doing work at the weekends and so on." And he said, "No, no, I'm not asking you how you coped with the pressure. I'm asking you, what did you do about the fact that you recognised the pressure was harming your health?" And she said, "Well, like I said, I was taking work home with me and I was working with..." And he said, "No, no, no, I'm not asking you how you cope with the pressure. You have told us that, whenever it was, you know, March or whatever, you realised that this was harming your health. So to safeguard your health, what did you do?" And she said exactly the wrong thing at that point. She said, "Well, what could I do?" And then he rattled it off. Yeah, she like opened the door to this onslaught. He said, "You could have raised it with your head of department in supervision. You could have asked for an appointment with the principal of the college. You could have asked to speak to one of the governors of the college. You could have raised this with your trade union. You could have raised it with your professional association. You could have consulted a solicitor. You could have..." Do you see how this list went on? But all the things she could have done. And so after he'd finished this long list, he then turned to her and said, "And so which of those did you do?" And she said, "I didn't do any of them." And before she had finished, before she had finished saying, "I didn't do any of them," like about halfway through that sentence, he cut across her, the barrister cut across her, and said, "No more questions, Your Honour," and sat down. In other words, case one. Do you see how that works? He had basically shown you cannot sue your employer for a lack of a duty of care when you did not show a duty of care to yourself. That it doesn't work that way. What she should have done, legally speaking, is put her employers on notice. That's the technical term, putting on notice. It's basically saying, "I want you to know that my current level of pressure is harming my health." That should then trigger a response from the organisation. Because if it did come to a court case at a later date, do you see how the claimant would have a very strong case if they can say, "Here are the supervision notes," or "Here's a copy of the email that was sent," or "Here is a copy of the letter I sent to whoever. Do you see how it's going to be very difficult for the employees to turn round and say, "We were not aware of this problem, so don't blame us for not doing anything about it." But can you see how that works? It's a shared responsibility. Because there's a subjective and an objective side to stress. Employers have got to be careful that they don't overload people But then we've got to be careful as professionals that we don't overload ourselves. Can you see how that fits in with what we were talking about the other day about the sedimentation model? Do you see, if we try to do everything for everybody, if we try to solve everybody's problems, we try to meet everybody's needs, rather than sticking to our agreed plan, then we're in danger of stressing ourselves out, and we'll only have ourselves to blame for that. You know, if that's what we are doing, not what our employers are forcing us to do, then we wouldn't have any defence, in a sense, of our unhelpful behaviour. Okay, so you're happy you've got a clear, fairly clear picture of what we're looking at here? Yeah, great. Okay, now what I want to look at is the three dimensions of stress. And this is, in a sense, this is a development in our thinking, because the traditional model of stress is a two-dimensional model. It's sort of, it focuses on two things. The pressures we face, and the technical term for that is stressors, you know, that's the sort of the textbook term. The pressures we face, the potential sources of stress, are known in the textbooks as stressors. But then we've got our coping methods, we've got our ways of dealing with that. So the traditional view is that these two do battle, as it were. They fight it out. So if the stressors, if the pressures are too strong for our coping methods will be overwhelmed, and the result will be stress. But if our coping methods are strong enough to withstand the pressures, to deal with them effectively, then the coping methods will win, and we won't experience stress. Can you see how that's a very simple, basic, two-dimensional model of stress? You have pressures on you, you have your ways of coping. Whether you feel stress, and I mean stress now as opposed to just pressure, where it's actually harming you, if you experience stress, it's because the pressures have proven greater than your coping abilities. So traditionally, all the emphasis has been on improving your coping abilities, of boosting your coping abilities. But if you think about it, according to this model, if you experience stress, whose fault is it? Yeah, it's your own, isn't it? So do you see how there's an element there of what they call blaming the victim? Let's imagine I was your boss, and you've got a manageable workload, and you're doing really well. And I come along to you and say, you're doing really well, in fact, you're doing so well, I'm going to double your workload. And to my great surprise, you still manage to do really well. You know that you are superb at coping with pressure, and you're still okay with double the workload. So I double it again, and again. Do you see what I'm getting at? Sooner or later, too much is too much for anybody, isn't it? You know, we all have our limits. So do you see how to say, if you are not coping, it's your own fault, is basically, potentially, blaming the victim. It's the technical term for it is that this is a pathologizing model. Anybody who experiences stress is being pathologized. They're being shown to be, in a sense, weak, inadequate, not up to it. And is that often not how stress is seen? Yeah, you know, that somebody who's having stress is seen as, you know, weak, not coping, not up to it. So they're pathologized by that. They're almost sort of victimized, in a sense, by that. I was asked once as a consultant to work with a voluntary organization that had 96 staff. They were having problems with stress, they said, so they wanted me to work with them because they knew I had an interest in stress. You know, I'd done research about stress and so on and so forth. They asked me to be a consultant to them to try and help them deal with their stress. And I did various things with them, one of which was to design a questionnaire to measure levels of pressure in that organization. And because this was like from a senior management initiative that they'd brought me in, they made it compulsory that everybody fills in this stress questionnaire. So all 96 people filled it in, which of course is unusual to get 100% return rate. But all 96 people filled this in. And according to the scale that I used, all 96 of them were in the red danger zone of stress. Yeah, can you imagine from low pressure to medium pressure to high pressure to too high pressure? According to that questionnaire, all of them, every single one of them, 96, were in that stress zone, if you like, at the top of the pressure range. What are the chances of those 96 people all being weak, inadequate people? That's like winning the lottery 3 weekends on the run, isn't it? Do you see what I'm getting at? The chances that they just happen to every single person that they employ turns out to be a weak, inadequate person. You know, what are the chances of that? So do you see how it's back to our organisational context stuff here? It wasn't about individuals. It was about something happening in that organisation. And after our discussions yesterday, it probably won't come as a surprise to you to hear that it was the culture. Yeah, that the culture was a very unhealthy culture that was contributing to stress there. There was this sense that they had to do everything right, that they had to have 100% success rate. So everybody felt this huge pressure, you know, that they must tick all the boxes, they must succeed in everything they do, which was just totally unrealistic. You know, can you imagine a sports person having this idea that they lose one match, they lose one game, even they draw a game, so they don't have a completely 100% success rate, that they're a failure and they should be ashamed of themselves. Can you see how quickly that would lead to stress if that was the case? That was the culture in this organisation, this expectation of, oh, we didn't get that right. Well, that's life, you won't get everything right. But you see how it became a powerful culture influencing them. So this two-dimensional model is unhelpful. It can actually make the situation worse. Because if somebody is experiencing stress and there's a two-dimensional model operating, it's seen as the sign of a weak individual, do you see how that's going to discourage them from asking for help? Do you see how at that very moment when people need help most, a two-dimensional model is going to discourage them from basically saying, I'm sticking my hand up, I'm confessing, I'm a weak, inadequate person, I need help. And clearly, that's not appropriate, that's not helpful, that's disempowering. So we have to add a third dimension. And that third dimension is support. And when we add that third dimension, it changes everything. Because let's look at what's the relationship between the stressors, that is the pressures, and the support. How do they relate to each other? So let's start off with a positive picture of where there's good support. What do you think that does in terms of people's pressures? How do you think it affects people's pressures if they know they've got good support? It eases the burden, it helps to keep the pressures in perspective, it's a positive effect. What if you've got no support? What if you know you're on your own, mate? Yeah, anything goes wrong, you fall flat on your face, nobody's going to pick you up and look after you and make you a cup of tea. In fact, they might walk on you while you're on the ground. You know you're on your own, you've got no support. What does that do in terms of your pressures? Yeah, that's right. It increases your pressures. They loom large. So do you see how support can either help or hinder, can make it better or it can make it worse? So that's what you might call a double whammy. Do you see what I'm getting at? The absence of support not only fails to support you in relation to your pressures, but actually makes those pressures worse. The absence of support becomes part of the problem rather than part of the solution. Let's look at the other side of the coin. The relationship between support and coping methods. Let's start again with the positives. What does good support do in terms of your coping methods? Yep, exactly, yes. So is it fair to say then that support will boost or enhance your coping abilities? Yep. Yes, support is very important in terms of that. Because if you draw a parallel, for example, with grief, then grief can put immense emotional pressures on people, can potentially be stressful. But what the research has shown for a long time is one of the key factors in relation to grieving is social support. If people feel supported, they're likely to cope much better with their grief and be less prone then to being stressed by the experience of loss that they've been going through. Let's look at it now in a negative sense then. What if you haven't got support? What does that do in terms of your coping methods? If again, you know, you're on your own, it's just down to you. What might that do in terms of your coping methods? What it's likely to do is reduce them, isn't it? Just so it will undermine your ability to cope. If you feel you've got all these pressures on you, you've got nowhere to go with them, nobody to back you up, nobody to support you, you know if things go wrong, you're on your own, then do you see how that can significantly undermine your confidence, undermine your ability to cope? So do you see how we've got another double whammy here? That support can boost your coping methods, or the absence of support can reduce your coping methods. So again, there's no middle ground. Do you see how there's no neutral middle ground? That support will either make it better or make it worse. So now what you've got, and I don't know if there is such a term, but if there isn't, I'm inventing it now, you've got a quadruple whammy. Can you see how the presence of support will reduce your pressures and increase your coping abilities? So it's a double boost where there is support present. But where there is no support present, it will increase your pressures and decrease your ability to cope. So it's a double blow, in a sense, to your ability to cope, the absence of support. So do you see how the choice in terms of support is between a double boost or a double blow? You either go up the coping ladder 2 steps or down 2 steps. So the difference is 4 steps. Can you see what I'm getting at? That's why support is crucial. That's why a two-dimensional model of stress is dangerous. This idea of, if you can't stand the heat, get out the kitchen. You know that sort of macho approach to pressure? You're paid to cope, bloody get on with it. Do you see how that attitude from organisations, when there's that culture, that sort of macho culture around pressure, can be very harmful indeed. It can ruin people's lives, and has. You know, there are plenty of cases on record of where people's lives have been ruined by that sort of mentality becomes established as a culture of, you know, this is a tough job, you've got to be tough to work here, no namby-pamby whinging about stress. Can you see how that can be very harmful for people? Especially when you bear in mind the subjective elements of stress, you know, that there may be some things that people find extremely difficult to deal with that other people take in their stride. I mean, an example of that would be what I mentioned a moment ago, grief. Do you see how if somebody in a team has had, say, a number of significant losses in their life, then having to deal with somebody who's grieving may be extremely difficult for them. Whereas for somebody who hasn't got those sort of raw experiences of grief, may find it no problem at all to deal with somebody who is grieving. So again, you have to take account of that subjective element. So what do you make of this three-dimensional model then? How does that grab you? You can hopefully see the significance of it, how we've got to have support in there, and you see how that fits with the organisational context stuff. That's why this is on our agenda for this module, the organisational context stuff about support. But it's also about professionalism, in the sense that part of professionalism is what we discussed the other day, was the idea of a professional body. And again, that may well be an organisation, but it doesn't have to be an organisation. It's that sense that we are in this together, you know, that we are part of a profession. Do you see how that's where a lot of support can come from? from that sense of we are supporting each other as members of a profession, of a professional body. Okay, everybody reasonably clear about it? Great. What we're going to do now then is to look at what you can do about it. How can you avoid stress? How can you deal with stress if it arises and so on? And there are various tools that you can use. But I want to look at two in particular. It's more of a general theme and then a particular tool related to that theme. And the general theme is the importance of control. We have known for literally decades that control is a key factor in relation to stress, in the sense that some people can have huge amount of pressure on them, which they cope with admirably as long as they've got control. Whereas other people could have a fairly modest amount of pressure on them that stresses them out because they've got little or no control over it. Now, that's partly why empowerment is such an important concept in social work, because with the families and the individuals, the communities that we work with, often people we work with will have no sense of control. They may be stressed or at least pressurized because they have no sense of control over their circumstances. And so by helping them to solve their own problems rather than just make them dependent by giving them services, do you see how what we're doing is helping to gain greater control so that they are able to cope with their pressures better? We are sort of de-stressing people, or helping to de-stress, by getting people perhaps to understand better what's happening to them so that they've got better understanding and give them better control over what is going on. Let's say, for example, in a children's services context, you may have parents who have got a child or a young person who's going off the rails, shall we say. And it may be a key factor in that, as family therapy has taught us, a key factor in that may be that the parents are not communicating. There's little or no communication going on between the parents. And you see how then you may have an 8-year-old, a 12-year-old or whatever who is then responding adversely to the tension in the household, the sense of insecurity that is coming from parents who just don't communicate with one another. They like live in separate worlds. So can you see how if the parents say, we need help, our son, our daughter is, you know, staying out till 2 o'clock in the morning and ignoring everything we ask them to do and so on and so forth, we're just not coping. Do you see how they're likely to feel powerless? They're likely to feel stressed by that situation, that they can't cope with it. They've actually come and asked for professional help. Now, do you see how easy it is to make them dependent at that point, say, yeah, we'll solve your problem for you? But an empowering approach would not be about solving their problem for them. It would be about helping them solve their own problem. And then perhaps it emerges through the assessment that part of the problem is the parents don't actually communicate with one another and create a very tense, insecure family environment. But you see how helping them to recognise that and saying, look, I think part of the problem here is that there's a lot of tension and insecurity going on. I think your child is reacting badly to that. So let's look at how you create a more secure home environment, how you do that, you know, through communicating better and perhaps help them to do that. Which, you know, as I say, is often what family therapy is about, is helping families to communicate better with each other. They reduce the tension, they reduce the anxiety, they reduce then the adverse reaction to that. Because can you see how that will cause a vicious circle? That if you've got a child in a family who is having behavioural difficulty, shall we say, in response to parental communication issues, that may actually make the household even more tense. And the more tense it becomes, the less communication goes on, or the more that communication becomes like barbed. You know what I mean? That there's an edge to the communication, so it then makes the problem worse. So that's where the empowerment bit comes in, is about helping them to understand the situation so they can then control it and say, well, look, if you don't want your child to react badly to the tension in the household, let's do something about the tension in the household. And perhaps part of that is we need to look at how you communicate together, how you show, say, a united front. Can you see how that might work in that situation? So that is a general example of how in social work, empowerment, the importance of giving people or helping people to gain control over their lives is important. But that applies to us just as much as it does to the people we work with. Do you see how we have to have a sense of control? And that's where it fits in with the professionalism. If we buy into a bureaucratic discourse that we're just there to do what our boss says, to go out, do an assessment, give somebody a service, or apologise for not giving them a service because the budget's run out, fill in the paperwork, keep the computer system happy, and then go on to do the next one. Do you see how there's no sense of control in that? There's no sense of professional autonomy. We are just doing routine work there, which is not going to be stimulating, rewarding, is not going to satisfy the values that brought us into the work in the first place. So one of the things we have to do in terms of stress is, if we're starting to feel stressed or we're worried that we may become stressed, we want to prevent stress, is to look at what we can control. And if we're helping other people to either avoid stress or to deal with stress they're already experiencing, then again, it's helping them to gain control. That's the empowerment bit. Okay, is that reasonably clear? Yeah, the significance of control. Now, one other point I want to make about control before we move on to the particular tool built on this is we have to understand that nobody has complete control over their life. It's not about complete control. There will always be things you cannot control, even if it's just the weather. Do you see what I'm getting at? It's not about getting complete control. Because, you know, some people get described as control freaks. And a control freak is somebody who's trying to control things that can't be controlled. You see how they've gone overboard with the control issue. So nobody has complete control, but nobody has no control. For example, Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist writer, gives a perfect example of this. Imagine a man in prison, prisoner in his cell. You might think totally constrained, you know, locked up in a prison cell, got no control over what happens. Then it's meal time. Prison officer comes along with a tray of food, puts it on the table in the cell, and then leaves it there. Do you see how the prisoner in the cell has the choice of, do they eat the food? Do they just leave it there? Do they throw it around the room? What do they do with it? So do you see how even in a very constrained situation like being in prison, people still have some degree of control? So our range of control never goes to zero and never goes to 100%. It's always somewhere in the middle. And that's important to remember that. Now, what we're going to come on to now is a sort of a tool for this, dealing with this, called the CIA framework. Now, this is nothing to do with the American Intelligence Agency. Okay, that's just coincidence. What CIA stands for is Control, Influence, and Accept. And what this boils down to is this is actually a very helpful tool for dealing with stress issues. I've taught this on stress courses now for many, many years and had an awful lot of very positive feedback where, you know, people have said, this is going to make a big difference to me in terms of pressure and stress. So the idea of the CIA framework is this. There are things that you can control. Control them. Deal with them. There are things you can't control, but you can influence. Influence them. Do what you can. But there are some things that you can neither control nor influence. And don't get yourself worked up into a lather about it, because you just have to accept it. If you can't control it and you can't influence it, There's nothing you can do about it, so you have to learn to live with it. Now, the idea behind this is that people get stressed if they don't do this. So if you can control something and you don't, do you see how things can get out of hand? Where you could have done something about a situation, but you didn't. So that's a potential recipe then for stress, where you're not doing stuff that is within your control. People can get stressed because they could influence a situation, but they don't. They're chicken out, or they back out. This is back to the professional assertiveness theme. Yeah? That, you know, perhaps you could have had a conversation with your boss about the fact that you've been given too many referrals or whatever, or that you've been given something that's too difficult for you to deal with at this stage in your career development. But you don't, because you don't want to rock the boat. You don't want to create a bad relationship with your boss. So do you see how there are things you could have influenced, but you didn't? So you then potentially create stress for yourself. And then stress can also arise when there's something you can do absolutely nothing about, but you get yourself worked up about it, that you can't accept it. And for me, this is back to the sedimentation model, you know, recognizing we cannot solve everything for everybody, and trying to do that causes us problems. So sometimes you may have somebody who's in a dreadful situation, but there's nothing we can do about it. And you see how just worrying about that and fretting about it just stresses ourselves out. You know, if there's nothing we can do about it, then there's nothing we can do about it other than accept it or get stressed by it. Because if there is something we can do about it, fine, do it. But in those circumstances where there isn't, then clearly what we have to do is to accept it. At the moment, in terms of what I'm doing now, I can control what I do. As, you know, the tutor here, I can control what I say, what I write on the board, and things like that, you know, what direction we go in next, and so on and so forth. I can control that. What I can't control is your learning, but I can influence it. You see, if you want to sit there staring into space all day, then I can't stop you. I can try and make it interesting, I can try and make it relevant to your job, I can try and let you see how important this stuff is, so I can try and influence you, but you see how I can't control you. Yeah, if you're determined, you don't want to learn, you don't think this stuff is important, do you see how I can't control that, but I can influence it. But there are things that I can't control or influence. You know, I used the example of the weather before. You know, the weather would be an example of that. You know, there'd be lots of things that I couldn't control. And if there was a power cut now, so that all the lights went out, we lost the projector and everything and so on, do you see how I just have to accept that? I'd have to work around it. There's nothing I can do about it, so I have to accept it. But just getting worked up about the fact that the electricity went off at a crucial moment, do you see how I'm just adding more pressure to myself? So that's the CIA framework, and as I say, very helpful for making sure we don't cross that line from pressure to stress. I said, you know, a lot of people have told me they found this a useful framework. Some people have had it printed out on a sheet of paper in big letters and then had it laminated, you know, and put it on the wall by their desk or wherever, or put a, you know, copy of it in their diary as they go about, you know, to remember. Control what you can control, influence what you can influence. If you can't control it and you can't influence it, then the only two options you've got left is accept it or get stressed by it. Take your pick. And you see how that's down to you. I think that we can change the world, but one step at a time, yeah? A little bit here, a little bit there. The idea that, you know, as social workers, you know, there's going to be this great revolution and discrimination, oppression will disappear because of our efforts, you know, and no children will ever be abused again, and, you know, older people will be, you know, respected and so on because of social work, then, you know, I think I want to file that under fiction. But we can make a little difference here and a little difference there. Have you heard the starfish story, for example? It's a lovely story. I've done a lot of consultancy work with an organisation based in Shropshire that works with abused and traumatised children, an organisation called SACS. This is part of their story in a sense. They tell all their staff the starfish story. And they didn't invent it, but it goes something like this. There's a woman walking along a beach one evening, and there are lots of starfish that have been washed up onto the beach. And if they stay there, they will die. And so what the woman does is starts throwing them back into the water. And then a man comes along and says, "You're wasting your time. This happens every evening, that hundreds of these are washed up and die. It happens every evening. We can't help it. We can't do anything about it. We can't make a difference." And the woman bends down, picks one up, throws it into the water and says, "Made a difference for that one." Do you see the moral of the story, in a sense? We can't stop all the starfish getting beached, as it were, and dying, but some of them we can help. Yeah, and that's what should be motivating us, is that sort of the balance of that. We can make a positive difference, but not like in an idealistic sense that, you know, now we are here. It's just like, you know, if you draw a parallel with the police, okay, you know, somebody going into the police is not going to say, "Right, no crime from now on. You know, we're going to get this sus. Well, you know, like, give us till December, say. By December, we should have, you know, eradicated crime. We've changed the world," and so on. That ain't going to happen, is it, realistically? But you see how every police officer, with a value commitment to law and order and to justice and so on and so forth, can make a significant difference to the people that they encounter. So it's on that level that, as professionals, we're then contributing to the bigger picture. You know, I've used this phrase quite a few times during this module, and I said, the first time I used it, I said I'm going to be using this phrase a lot. Talk about individually and collectively. Do you see what I'm getting at? That's part of that idea of professionalism, that we are part of a collective, we're part of a whole, so we can make differences individually. You know, when you're sitting on somebody's settee, reassuring them about their anxieties and you're helping them to move forward with their problems and their issues, do you see how you're making a positive difference as an individual? But then collectively, you know, if we pull together to tackle the common issues, then that's how the collective side of it works. But either way, it's still not going to, as you say, change society in the sense that, you know, the answer to society's problems is social work. Yeah, I'm sure you can see that's naive. Can you see what I mean? For example, I've got a friend who works in a hospice, and, you know, when you talk about challenging work, that's about as challenging as it gets, because she basically works with two groups of people. She works with people who are dying or people who are grieving for people who are dying, and that, as you can see, emotionally at least, that's about as challenging as it gets. But she recognises she has to, you know, to survive in her job and be useful. She recognises that she has to be able to draw that line in a sense of empathy, not sympathy, and recognising if you've done your best, nobody can ask for more from that. And that, for me, I think what's significant about this is, you know, yesterday we touched on the stuff about radical social work. And I said, you know, there are benefits to radical social work and the history, the legacy it's left us, as well as some problems as well. And for me, part of the benefit of radical social work is it showed how social work is a political activity. Do you see what I'm getting at? That very often the situations we can't do anything are about policies and about societal attitudes and things like that, you know, so they're about that macro picture in a sense, which as individuals we can't do much about apart from, you know, vote every few years and so on. But you see how collectively we can have a say in that, you know, we can contribute to policy development and stuff like that. And that's part of, you know, what I was bemoaning the other day about. We have a fairly weak professional voice in the UK compared with, say, Australia or America or Canada or whatever, we have a fairly weak professional voice. Just one last example of that is, you know, when the Baby Peter case was hitting the headlines, well, just after that, Ed Balls, who was at that time the Minister for Children's Services, made an interesting comment. Because as the Minister for Children's Services in England, he was responsible for, amongst other people, childcare social workers and teachers. And what he said was, during his time as Minister for Children's Services, he constantly heard the voice of teachers. He had teachers' unions and professional associations constantly saying things like, we want more of this, we want less of that, we're not happy with this, you've got to work on that, talk to us about this. Whereas throughout his period of office as children's, as Minister for Children's Services, he not once heard the voice of social workers. He was not approached at all about, we want more of this, we want less of that. Do you see how there's no attempt to influence policy in relation to children's services from social workers, whereas teachers, now I know they're a bigger group because there's more of them, but do you see how they had a much stronger professional voice? So it takes us back to square one in a sense. You know, the starting point for this module is that we have a choice. Professionalism has been undermined over the years. We can either roll over and moan about it, or we can reaffirm our professionalism and build that professional voice. In a sense, the choice is ours.